those of you who care to, please join me in opening our meeting by reciting our AA prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The last 2 weeks, we've been asking ourselves some questions, and in the answers, trying to build for ourselves a house of sobriety. Because when I began this, those of you who have been here before will recall, I wanted to take as the theme for this month of what I like to refer to as workshop on alcoholism the sentence from next to the closing chapter of the book, which says, "See to it that your own house is in order, and great events will come to pass to you and countless others." And to build this house, what I put before it was 4 questions that had certainly figured largely in my sobriety and had come up again and again and again in my relations with others, with my companions on this road of happy destiny over the years. First question that was handled the first week, if you'll remember, was, what is the point of sobriety? I can't review all of this because tonight the question that we're going to take up, really, I ought to spend the whole month on it. And it's so big and there's so much ground to cover that several times today I wish that I could just go away. Wondered why the hell I began this at all. But the first question was, what is the point of sobriety? The question that you ask many, many times before you get here, and believe me, you ask it again and again after you get here. And certainly, this is the question that the newcomer ought to contemplate, because until he's answered this question, everything else that I or any other member of AA say from the podium or even privately to you is largely wind in the trees. We can discuss old ideas, as I hope to do tonight. We can discuss spiritual experiences. We can discuss the steps. We can discuss the book. We can discuss anything. But until you are staying away from the first drink, it's largely just exercise. And the answer to that question that we arrived at was that if you are an alcoholic, the point of sobriety is simply that you have chosen to live. It is assumed that you have chosen to live, and that is why you decide to stay away from the first drink. Last week, we took the question in a step further and said, is it necessary to have a spiritual experience in order to maintain sobriety? And we found that the answer to that, technically, theoretically, is no. No, you don't have to be virtuous. You don't have to be spiritual. You don't have to be anything to accomplish the physical act of staying away from the first drink. And if you can keep that in your mind, you have removed an alibi for your future drinking, if any, which is a great alibi. How many people have rationalized that first drink by saying, well, I can't do it. I can't work the steps. I can't get this peace and serenity and spiritual well-being that everybody else has, so I get drunk. And this is what it is in rationalization. Because, for instance, today, I talked to 2 people on the telephone. They ranged in sobriety from 4 months to 5 years. Both of them were about as objective and despondent as 2 people could get, and yet each one of them knew, as we talked, that it was in their power to stay away from the first drink, that they could do it. Whether they want to do it or not, that's in their hands. However, if you go on with that question, and you take as the definition of spiritual experience, the definition is given in the appendix of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is that this is not a great awakening, this is not a great religious experience, this is not a sweeping of the wind from the mountaintop through every pore of your body. What it is a gradual change in your reaction to life, to reality, in in the way that you react to the world around you, to yourself, and to life as it comes to you. And the answer to that question is yes. If there's going to be any change, if you're going to be sober, drunk and miserable, and now become sober and miserable, then you don't need a spiritual experience. But if you want to make some kind of a change, if this life that you have chosen to live wants to be more for the living, then yes, the answer is yes. There must be, there absolutely has to be a spiritual experience. And when I say this, remember, I'm using the definition in no religious sense whatever. The definition is as given in the appendix to the book. If you haven't read it, read it, and then you'll know what we're talking about. That it is a change that comes about through what you do, through the steps you take, and the life, and the thinking that you do, the meditating you do, the effort that you put forth, a gradual change in your attitude toward life, toward yourself, and toward the world around you. Now, we last week then quickly considered how the AA program begins this. And we took the steps 1 through 5. Now let's assume that's the review. One more thing. Anything that I say up here, surely by now you know it. I wish I had it engraved on my head, then I wouldn't have to say all the time. Or maybe a little sign that sticks up behind me. I do not speak officially for Alcoholics Anonymous, neither does anyone else, including the founder. There is no official viewpoint. Even the book is suggestive, as it points out over and over and over again. So if anything that I say up here distresses you, the simplest thing to do is to ignore it. There is no point in being distressed because there is no orthodoxy in AA. All I am doing is what everybody else does. Put suggestions before you based on my own experience and the experience of others. So please keep that in mind. Anything I say can be held against me, but it can't be held against AA. Right? Let's go. Now let us suppose that we have, as we ended up last week, we've taken steps 1 through 5. And we didn't take them to the best of our ability because we found out there ain't no such thing. Well, more of that later. We took them. That's the important thing. We knuckled down and we took them. And we left the perfection of our taking them in the hands of a power greater than ourselves. Now, generally what happens at the end of this, when you get through with all of this and you wipe the perspiration of humility from your brow, most of us, well, we would make Tiny Tim look like a sword. With most people, especially ones who've never done it before, the reaction is just absolutely miraculous. And I think maybe this is that phrase that you hear so much when you come into AA that you call the honeymoon, or cloud nine. I always thought they were talking when they said about the honeymoon in AA was that you had found yourself a sober partner. But, and of course, if you have done this before, then the reaction is left. I didn't get such a terrific, ecstatic bang out of it because, from my background, I had been doing a reasonable facsimile of this for a long, long time, with, I might say, no noticeable peace of mind ensuing. But mainly, for most people, it's a really wonderful thing. The load goes off, deep breath is taken, life has changed, you feel cleansed, and suddenly everything is good, and the wife, the kids, the job, everything seems... Well, you wondered before, you wonder, what the hell was I so fucked about before? Everything is sweet. Everything is great. Everything is fine. And then little by little by little by little, the light in the eyes dims, the snarl begins to replace the smile. A little thing called hostility begins to rear its ugly head. And then comes the question of what the hell is the matter? I did everything. I did everything it said. I wrote it all down. I went and I found this jerk and I told everything to him or her. And I've been making amends and I've been doing all these other things. And I feel like hell. What's more, I'm not really any better. Now, why could that be? Well, I think there are three reasons, and I'll put them out for you. It took me a long time, because you see, as I said before I got here, I had been doing this for a long, long time, in the religion that I was born and brought up in. Except you didn't write it down. You were supposed to know it well enough not to write it down. You didn't need to write it down, because you did so often. Let us think first what one of the first reasons might be, and I think one of the common reasons is, if you stop to think about it, what really has happened, and the thing that contributes to this, is that you are coming face to face now, day after day after day, with a little thing called reality. It may not really be reality, as you will later find it to be, as you will later come to know it, but nevertheless, you are not calling off and taking leave via food or pill. You are not dismissing the whole thing, you know, in a vapor of booze or some other kind of chemical substance that's going to change your thinking. You stand there, you've taken a stand, you have quit running physically, let us say, and you have, that thing is there, days is there, life is there, day after day after day. And you find that after all that you have done, life remains pretty much the same. One of the great discoveries that you will make here, sooner or later, is that AA offers you no immunity, or, as well as any other organization on the face of the earth, any immunity from the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. They will occur. Life has a way of seeing that they do. And there's, just because you're in here, and we've got some steps, and we're all staying sober together, doesn't mean that we now have an invincible armor that we go through life, and we never again have a worry. Of course, the trouble is that this is what most of us have been looking for all of our lives. I certainly was looking for it. I wanted to find that day, that thing, that sacrament, or that combination of prayers that would put this thing on me, and by God, the arrows would just fall off. That's all it was going to be. I went through, see? The other reason might be, too, that we are discovering the great fallacy that a virtue assumed is not necessarily a virtue acquired. Now, this comes as a great shock, because you have been taught that this is so. How many times have you been taught? Practice humility if you want to be humble. Fine. Good, I'm glad. The other day I was talking to a guy who's been sober about 4 months, and we were having a really pretty, very, very good talk. And suddenly he said, "You know how I'm handling everything up to now?" And I said, "No, I am." And he said, "At the slightest sign of anything going wrong, I say, 'I'm sorry, forgive me.'" And then he drew a deep breath and he said, "But I don't know how long I could keep it up." And I wanted to laugh, and I wanted to cry, because I wanted to laugh because it was like a tape recorder of my past. I remember the first 3 months that I was in here preparing myself for canonization. I was one day walking down the corridor of my office, and it's the way this thing is arranged, the acoustics, as you walk toward certain offices, even though they were talking in a normal voice, it was just as though a sound system carried it down the corridor. As I was walking toward this particular office, I heard this guy say, "Here comes McGinnis." And he's got that look again. He's going to apologize. And that was true. I spent months just apologizing. It didn't even occur to me whether or not anybody wanted this or expected it. I just went around apologizing. That way I thought, this is very good. This is money in the bank. Now, in case I finally call off and hit somebody, I don't have to apologize to them first. So this is, but we have been doing this all of our lives. We're taught to do it. And we are taught that it works. All of the evidence to the contrary, we ignore that, because that would shake the foundations of some of our beliefs, and we're going to get to that a little later, though. Now, what could be the third reason? And I think by far the most important and the most basic. Could it be that this guilt that we thought we had gotten rid of, that we took all these steps to do, this will in our life over the power, care of a power greater than ourselves. We took a written inventory, and we admitted this to God and to ourselves and to another human being. Logically, that should get rid of it, shouldn't it? Well, it would if we were dealing with logic. But unfortunately, we're not dealing with logic. We're not dealing with logical guilt. We're dealing with emotion. Really, what we have, after you get put aside the physical allergy that alcoholism develops, is we have an emotional disease. We are emotionally troubled, emotionally ill, and then let's define that so that we'll all know the same thing that we're talking about. What is an emotion? Well, emotion really is a physical response to a thought. You have to have the thought first before you have an emotion. The emotion is the reaction to it. So what we have been doing is we have been emotionally ill in our thinking. The guilt that we have been feeling has nothing to do with logic, and although we have put a lot of logical guilt with it, way back before the logical guilt came along, there was a subjective guilt. And how did that come about? Now that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. I finally arrived there. And we go to the sentence in the book called, "Many of us trying to hang on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely." Let's talk then about old ideas. The old ideas that are behind these emotions, that are behind these acts, that are behind these feelings, that haunt us, that torment us, that bug us, that come back again and again and again. Whether after we've taken the fourth step, after we've taken the fifth step, after we've taken the tenth step, again and again and again, they come back. Why? Could it be that they began long before there was any logic? Could it be that the truth that I believe, that every human being that walks through the door of this AA meeting or any other AA meeting, as a matter of fact, any human being that walks through the door probably is the door of a cathedral, the door of a church, the door of a synagogue, the door of a temple, the first time, the door of a psychiatrist's office the first time, and we're talking now here about coming through the door of an AA meeting for the first time. We all have one great thing in common. One great basic thing in common. Deep down inside of us, we are consumed with self-hatred, self-condemnation, self-abnegation. We, no matter what our outward appearance is, and no matter what the facts of our life are, no matter how successful we've been, how much money we have in the bank, how many kids we have, or dollars, or cars, or what, and how many people look and say, "My God, what did that guy hate himself about?" Deep down inside, there is this total conviction that we are unworthy, unworthy. We don't deserve anything. What we deserve is doom and perdition. Where did it come from? Does it have anything to do with logic? I think not. I think it starts. Certainly, I believe this in my case, and as I say, I'm talking about what I have come to believe about me. I put it out to see if it finds any echo in you. Although, God knows I have found an echo in an awful lot of people that I've talked to over the years. Everybody that I've ever talked to in AA, every alcoholic, when you get down, you're going through it, our childhoods are nearly always the same, no matter what the circumstances or the environment. Somewhere along the line, those figures of authority, mama, papa, and whoever else was their substitutes or their cohorts, got it across to us in clear and unmistakable terms that we hadn't made it, that we had not won their love, that we had not won their approval. Now, of course, this is based on an old idea of theirs, and that is that if you earn approval, you earn it. You have to perform and get it. It's not coming to you otherwise. How clearly I remember that one of the most persistent things of my childhood, one of the first sentences I remember, as a matter of fact, was, "Be good, Alan, or God won't love you." Now, some years later, I discovered that theologically this was an absolute falsehood. As a matter of fact, it was heresy. My mother and father and all the nuns and the priests and everything could have been run out of the county for saying that, but the Pope asked them. But the harm had been done. The harm had been done. I had gotten clearly in my head that first I had to perform. And the basic need, the crying need of any human being, every man and every woman, barring a woman, is that they must matter of themselves. There must be worth. There must be love simply because they exist. Until you believe that, until you have found that, you have a search the rest of your life. And you use some of the strangest methods of finding it, trying to find it. Now, if this has gotten over to you, and you have the idea that you perform to get this, that mama and dad is first, of course, they're synonymous with God because they represent God. All you know about God is how mom and pop feel, because they're the giants of your childhood, with their aides that they employ, such as teachers, brothers, sisters, nurses, aunts, uncles, law. How many of you have been frightened with policemen when you were a kid? You don't behave, I'm going to call the police. You test it. The child tests it. He says, well, I will perform. I will win their love. So he tries. He tries in every way he knows. First, by what he thinks is his definition of being good. But since he's dealing with neurotics, or this wouldn't happen, he's never good enough. Never. He can't quite make it. Oh, another old idea, that the best way to be disciplined is to withhold approval, to withhold love. So, no matter how well he performs, he can't get this. Here, right away, here, we see the root, the beginning of that thing that haunts the neurotic and the alcoholic, is that he must be better. He must be better. Two things are already being born. The perfection of conflict and the aggressiveness. You know, there are a lot of books out today. Number one right now that's hitting the bestseller list called The Naked Age, that says that the real theme of this book is that man's aggressiveness is instinctive and that he is a violent creature. But there is a whole body of opinion that's been around for a long time. It's not written as sensationally as books like The Naked Age. They're written much more soundly. They're much more, the anthropologists, the sociologists that have done this work are much less spectacular, and they don't make the bestseller list. But I was reading one of them not long ago, and I love the way he summarized his paper on this thing. With a beautiful paraphrase of one of Shakespeare's great lines. He says, the fault lies not in our nature, but in our nurture. And from my viewpoint, I subscribe to this 100%. Now, the guilt, the feeling of unworthiness, that now must be replaced with a constant aggressiveness. I must be better, I must be better, I must be better. Now, these same parents, nuns, teachers, whoever they are in your background, I'm sorry that I keep referring to mine, but then I know my background a little better than I know anybody else's. They, too, add to this because they are making up for their guilt. So you, in a way, are doing their work, too. I'm quite sure that really what my mother had in mind, now I look back knowing that she was a very unhappy and a very tormented and a very guilt-ridden woman, despite all of her prayers and individuals, was that what she was trying to do with her family was to take us and hold us in her hand and make a burnt offering of us to God and say, look, God, see what I've done. Here are all these little plaster things I have produced, and now they are yours, and please now be easy on me. And, of course, she lived to see her dreams go down in dust. Because we never made it. How could we? Mama's guilt could not be wiped out because it wasn't real. So nothing the kid did ever wiped this out. Ever wiped it out. We tried. I come from a long line of perfectionists. And I come from a long line of competitors. As a matter of fact, the whole thing, the climate in which I was brought up, and I found this again and again in other alcoholics I talked to, there was no climate of love. There was a climate of competition, a climate of humiliation, a climate of always, and we were always being compared with everybody else, not just with each other. That would have been, because we could have always, I remember thinking how I could plot to catch my brothers and sisters in sin. But I couldn't.
couldn't compete against the whole town and the whole school, but that's what I was thrown in. I could come home with the report card, and it would have straight A pluses right down the line. And then we would get over to mathematics, where I never was too strong, because I didn't like the nun to talk mathematics. And there would be a B, let us say. And Mama looked at that B and those A pluses, then we had a big conference. And it always ended up by saying, what does Daniel McCafferty get in mathematics? You know? What does Patrick McMahon get? See? So, now, but long before we get to this age, this little kid, this little child is testing whether or not he can perform, testing whether or not he can win this over. And of course, he doesn't. He doesn't do it. So he begins to feel that there must be something wrong with him. That could be the only possible explanation that there could be. There's something wrong with him. He doesn't know that anybody else is going through with this. He doesn't know it at all. He simply tests. He tries. Now, later on, he is going to, as I did, alternate trying and not trying, trying and not trying. That's why so many of us have the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde pattern of life. That's why so many of us subscribe to the old idea of all or nothing at all. Because this is the only way you could live. There was now, how could you live with perfection-minded figures of authority out of your childhood if you're going to say, well, I'll just walk the middle road. I remember one time in confession being told by a wise, wise priest that he said, and he broke the seal of the confession by calling me by my name. Of course, I went so often, it was hardly often. He had no chance of not knowing who it was. But he turned and put that through the grill. He said, Alan, for you, virtue lies in the middle road. And I thought, came out, I was an old man who's lost his, you know, he doesn't really know what he's talking about. How could virtue lie in the middle road? Virtue is excellence. Virtue is the summit. Virtue is the top. What's the top that becomes of all this guilt? Is this guilt that's going to go along by itself all this time? Is the child going to be mental being all his life? No. Pretty soon he has anger. The inevitable result of guilt and unworthiness is anger. Because after he's tested it, after he's done everything that he can think of and he can't win, it's always more and more and more. He quits and he says, well, I won't. And now he has to express this anger. But anger doesn't go away. Guilt doesn't go away until you find out what's causing it. First time he tries the anger, he finds out that he had better never do it again. Because he is slapped by this little tiny kid. He is put in his place, and he's put in his place besides physical. He's put in his place with the cruelest kind of punishment at all, the one that I referred to, and it's the tough. It's not so good. The withholding of approval. The withholding of acceptance. The withholding of love. Now, what is he going to do with his anger if he can't express it? He starts turning it in upon himself. And we have the beginning of a neurosis because, after all, that's what the neurotic pattern is. It's a pattern of self-destructive behavior, compulsive, that a drama that is being enacted over and over and over again. And he begins to do things that occur to him that he thinks that he has found out in his childhood that are the worst things that he could possibly do. Even though the moralist named them, far different reasons centuries ago, they ended up being incredibly accurate. Because these secret sins, these secret transgressions that so haunt and torment the childhood of so many of us, it's not by accident, I guess, that even the old moralists all long ago called them under the all-inclusive term of self-abuse. Because that's really what it was. It was anger turned in upon yourself. Anger that increased the guilt, anger that could not be expressed any other way. And of course now the guilt is becoming logical and objective guilt because the child is doing things that he has been taught are wrong. What can result now from guilt and anger? There's no place else to go. Fear. Fear is going to become the constant companion, the preferred companion, really. And he fears largely divides himself into two groups, the fear of punishment and the fear of discovery. And I hope that they ring as much of a bell with you as they did with me. when I first finally got it all set down and finally said, what in the hell am I really afraid of? I had been calling them all.
Oh, how, I don't know. We all love that. Feelings of any doom.
When I finally sat down and thought about it, I was afraid that I was going to be discovered. I was afraid that I was going to be punished. And finally, I had to face it there. As I was talking the other night, some of you may have heard me say this before, I finally said to myself, all right, what if the Los Angeles Times came out tomorrow, July the 19th, or this is a while back, and the headlines in types that hadn't been used since Pearl Harbor, says, McGinnis exposed. The true facts about Alan Reed, Francis Xavier McGinnis, as told to Otis Chandler. What would I do? It's the ultimate fear. The fear of discovery. And it matters a lot more, I'm telling you, than the fear of God. Let's get right down to it. Because you see, by the time I was about 10 years old, my announced objective in life, the only real objective I had, all I hoped and all my activity and all my prayers and all my penances were directed at really only one objective. I just wanted to make it to purgatory. I figured if I got there, that's about all I could ask for. That would be good enough. Heaven, who in the hell is going to make it to heaven? But I just get to purgatory. Now, you stay there, of course, you know, for eons. It's all right. Just make it there. Just make it there. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you the truth. I hated myself so much. But with this guilt, this subjective guilt that I had made, very objective by my actions, by compulsive actions, I realize now, was that when I came into AA, and for many years afterwards, I really felt that what might finally get me win me salvation, what might finally get me past the judgment, was the fact that a man who hated himself as much as I did could not be all bad. I thought this might do it. Now, we talked about some old ideas. I've touched on just a few, because I think either that this is the unholy trinity that tyrannizes us. Guilt, anger, fear. Everything else comes out of them. But they have their little labyrinth, and they have their little tributary, and you will have to fill them in. As I said, there's enough. We could spend the whole month on this, and it might be very good to do it. But in one evening, with some questions here in my pocket to answer, I don't know how much further I can take it. I know this, that the reason it's so difficult to face these, the reason that we think, well, why doesn't one step, one taking of the fourth step, one taking of the fifth step hand us, is because, you see, we are fighting cherished beliefs that we have held all of our life. Because we were taught them. We were taught them. I put forth many, many reasons why my first go-round at this fellowship was a failure after the first 3 months, why I resigned and went my way. All of them that I have advanced are partially true. But really, there was one real main contributing thing all the time, and that was the cherished belief, the old idea I had that I came here with, never said it to a soul, never said it, never breathed it to a soul, was, well, hell, what can this thing be for me? What can this? I have been a member of the one true church that I, to myself, I have been taught it, I have believed it, and I have practiced it. Now, if that couldn't keep me from drinking, what the hell is this man-made organization that started in Akron, Ohio 14 years ago going to do for me? Well, that's why it was never real to me from the very beginning. I held on to that old idea. I had to come to grips with the most basic beliefs that I had. I had to come to grips with things that I had been saying all my life, all or nothing at all. If you want to be something, be it, and you will gradually become it. You don't really become what you're practicing. A man always ends up being what he thinks he is, way down deep here. It's always betrayed. You see, and this is the thing, this is the sad thing about how we try to compensate for this guilt and this fear and this anger. Because we all take the same course. I've never found anybody that did it, didn't do it. We adopt a two-way technique
that keep wiping each other out. On the one hand, we have this bottomless, tyrannical, insatiable need for approval, because since we hate ourselves, there has got to be this instant universal approval from everybody. And the tragic thing about this is how it betrays us, this satisfying this need, how we lie, how we fawn, how we flatter. The things we do, the asses we kiss, let's put it in plain words, to win it. The times that we compromise everything we believe in order to have this approval, and then wiping it out always, but the same people that we're trying to win over, because we are so afraid of them, and because we are so sure that we will one day be discovered, trying to cut them down, trying to keep them under control. The need to humiliate, the need to retaliate, the need to dominate, the need to excel. And of course, we are smiled upon all through all of this neurotic activity because it is the activity of our society. It is a favorite method of our culture and our environment. Hopefully, someday, maybe today's generation, are going to discover, and maybe they have already started, that this has got to go. Some of the old ideas have got to go. Before I get around to answering the question, I'm going to sum this up. I feel that I've done such an inadequate job because there's so much to say. The old ideas, and how do you let go of them? Next week, I hope to end up this session by putting forth some of the suggestions for you as to how you might try to begin to go about letting go of these things. But I would like to leave one thing in your mind. The real enemy of the truth, let's go back first to that, to a statement, we might even be bold enough to call it a revelation, of St. John, in the book of John, when John says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Nobody has ever quarreled with that, and it's been around in other words before John ever said it. Try then to remember this, what I have come to discover, and countless people before me. The real enemy of the truth is not too often the lie, the deliberate, committed, dishonest lie, but rather the myths that are so persistent and so persuasive because they are so unrealistic. Far too often in our lives, we cling to the cliches of our forefathers. We cling to the cliches that were handed to us. We suggest all of the facts that we have right in front of us to a prefabricated set of interpretations. And we end up enjoying, while we are dying, we enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought. And I'll leave it with you on that. Now I'll try to answer some questions after I have a glass of water. I looked at these questions beforehand, and some of them would take a whole evening. Why, after taking part as much as one can, when new, do you begin to feel apart from the feeling of not belonging? I think I've been talking about that. The feeling of not belonging is based on this subjective guilt, this feeling of unworthiness, this feeling that you will be discovered, this feeling, why do we suppose we have kept this wall up all our lives? It's the fear of discovery, the fear that someone else will find out and share the opinion that we have of ourselves. It's too bad that we sometimes don't trust the opinions of others, because sometimes they are always, in nearly every instance, more charitable to us than we are to ourselves. I told a lie to obtain money for drugs. The lie was, I said my wife and son got killed in an accident. How will I ever make amends for that? I don't think you should worry about that. A person who is in the grip of physical need for drugs can hardly be held morally responsible. That was the gist of it. The fact that you have written it now knows that you realize that you did something that is making you feel terribly, terribly guilty. We all have these things. I was talking with a guy the other day. There's things in my life that never have shown up on an inventory because they're not really morally, they have nothing morally wrong, and there's nothing about them that I would need to tell anybody. But I've gotten around to where I tell them because they free me. One of them, to give you an idea of what I mean by when you admit this, tell it to somebody and then forget it, because you're not morally responsible for that. I remember one of the things that has bugged me most all my life. I say all my life, for a number of years. I remember one time I was driving down the street, and I did nothing wrong, I can't remember now. And the guy in the other car that I had done this wrong thing to, cut in front of him or something, called me a son of a bitch.
And right away I reacted. And I cut in front of him, and I cut him off, and stopped the car.
And then I jump out of my car, and I go over to him, and I pull him in, and I said, "You called me a son of a bitch. And no man calls me a son of a bitch." And he got out of his car. And he said, "Yes, I called you a son of a bitch." And I backed out of it. And I tossed my lanyard. Well, there's no need of us losing our temper. And I got in the car, and I was sick. Sick to my stomach at what I had done. And I've never shown up on inventory, but a lot of the times when I was drunk, I remembered it. And often, sometimes, the memory of that will come back, and I actually get sick. Why? Because I was a coward. I was a coward. Matter of fact, most of the fighting I've done all my life was to prove that I wasn't afraid. And I never proved it to myself. Having been brainwashed by nuns and priests, they get scared to hell tonight, aren't they? Could you give some suggestions on how to take the first step? Yes. I'll tell you what was once told to me. And it was a great, great thing to me. It told me on a retreat. That was another thing I did when I discovered retreat. That's right, everything. Let's go on a retreat. Thinking, surely, you know, if I could keep my mouth shut for 3 days, I expected a miracle for it. So I was pouring out what I always poured out was my self-hatred, my self-condemnation, my self-worth. And the priest said to me, "Do you believe that God is love?" And I said, "Yes, that's the definition. I believe that God is love." And he says, "Do you believe then that he has shown some interest in you in your life? You have been baptized into a religion, you were brought up, you believe in God and everything. Would you then say, Alan, that God has shown some interest in you?" And I said, "Yes, I believe he is intensely interested in me. Intensely interested in me. I just wish I was more worthy of him." And then he said this. He said, "Then if God is love, you will have to follows as the night the day that he could not be interested in anything that is not lovable." If you can meditate on that, you can take the third step. Is it not necessary, as you acquire more honesty through working the programs, that you take more than one, fourth, and fifth step? What I have been talking here tonight is a continuation, I think, of the fourth and fifth step. But you stop doing it, and I'm glad that person was asked, because I wanted to bring this out and I wanted to emphasize it. Once you have taken it from a moral standpoint, from the standpoint of accusing yourself of moral wrong, you know, this is morally wrong and this is morally right. Once you have done that, I don't think you should ever do it again, because I don't think there's any need for it. I think that even though you remember things that maybe you forgot the first time around, there'll come an occasion when you can tell it. There'll be a right occasion, maybe when you're doing 12-step work, it's time to help somebody else, that you can tell something that you forgot. But don't, for God's sake, be picking at the sores of your past. This is the most destructive pastime that you can indulge in, and I know you will want to do it, because again, this comes from this need for perfection, this need to go over it and over it and over it and over it. From now on, as the therapy of AA progresses, try to take it from the standpoint of what was the motivation behind the behavior. Not quit thinking of it as right or wrong. What was it and what were you after? What was behind it and what was the result? Besides, the tenth step takes care of the day-to-day. Please discuss depression after a year's sobriety or more. I think all of the things that I have been talking about are answers to that question. Depression, discouragement, all these things come from the subjective feelings of guilt. The guilt, the anger, the suppressed anger, the fear. When you realize, begin to trace back go back again and again and again, because it's going to take time to see what you were after. And it'll be, sometimes it requires help. Somebody has to help you do this. To see what you were doing when you were performing these patterns of behavior. The guilt begins to go, because you are not out to offend God. You are not out to throw society off into a heap, a garbage heap. What were you doing, really, was trying to survive. Trying to get through one day after the other while you were consumed with this guilt and fear and anger. These were really, all these neurotic patterns were techniques of survival. And you couldn't blame a man if he swims to shore trying to save his life, if he swims in a way that the Olympic coach might not approve. He's got to get there, and this is what we did. And then one day, as we'll talk about next week, when you understand these enough that the self-condemnation begins to go, when a certain amount of self-acceptance comes, and self-acceptance then always has to lead to self-approval, you find out that you can make a choice. You can say to yourself, do I want to keep doing this or not? Do I have to follow this neurotic pattern or don't I? I know what I was after. I know what I was trying to do. Do I want to keep getting what I'm getting and pay the price for it, or don't I? Let's see, are there any others? Depression? No, I've answered them. And we have 10 minutes left. Are there any questions from the floor? Yes.
I heard many girls to the moral viewpoint and moral hidden for us. Now, in that mind, personally, but I use my moral code or maybe not a certain one.
It doesn't have to be one way or the other. When you take it, why don't you take it from both viewpoints? You can see how you feel and how whatever the conservative viewpoint is. As long as whatever you've done has been done honestly, as long as it, and to the degree of honesty that you're capable of on that particular given day, and you don't worry about what that degree is, you just do it. I think the first time around, well, it's so simple, really. You say, I did this. I was taught that it was very, very wrong. I don't feel that way now, but this is what I did. See, there is no problem. That's just the way you do it. The question was, if neurotic parents create neurotic, then the future neurotic, how can you try not to be a neurotic parent? Well, your children are growing up. You will grow up with them. And that's not said lightly. The McGinnises would have come out fine and dandy if this had taken place in our family. If the whole family had come along in the same way. What we needed in that family was love. We needed to love each other. No matter what we did to each other, that there was understanding, that we were willing to try it together, that there was to be no punishment, no constant withholding of approval, there was to be no competition, that we were going to make our mistakes together, and we were going to see it together. But we never did it that way. There was a goal, always a goal held in front of us that was unreachable, and nobody got there. And you, starting out, that's those children around you, you're going to grow with them. And as you grow, they will grow right along with you. And one day, their children will be a credit to you, to what you're doing now. I'll come back to you. For the children? Are you talking about the father? The father is a perfectionist for the children? Yeah. Are you the alcoholic? And he's a non-alcoholic? Have you suggested you go to Al-Anon? Well, he's doing what he can. The therapy has started. I doubt if he's the only perfectionist in the family, though. Okay, well, good. Now you're getting better. Yes.
Don't put on your children the burden of winning your place in society, or God, or in reality. Yes. I don't know how to answer this question about depression, because apparently it means a great many things to different people. My depression, I was told by those who are supposed to know that all my life I had a great deal of emotional resiliency, that I plunged to the depths, but apparently I plunged so hard and so fast I always fall. So my depressions were short-lived. I found out, though, that when I went around saying I was depressed, when I really went back to what triggered it, somebody had always hurt my feelings. Somebody had always made me feel not loved. And I wasn't appreciated. And by God, other people were getting the recognition due to me. So I was depressed. Now, that's the way it was with me. It was a form, as it was stirring up of the old guilt, the triggering of the old guilt, the little boy that couldn't win the approval, the little boy that couldn't be number one. This is the way it was all my life. I said once that I had a very simple technique of behavior. I was always jumping up in your lap to be petted. And if you didn't pet me, I jumped off your lap and I bit you. And generally, when you jump off the lap and bite people, you are in a depression. Anybody else? 1 minute to go. Who's going to ask the last question? No more? We'll quit a minute early. What? Huh? No. That's for another day, Luann. Thank you very, very much. I hope that I have tried to put this out. I don't know whether I did or not, but I tried. I'll see you here next week.